My name is Hemayana Naidi, and I want to welcome you to The Meeting Place Live, an opportunity to dialogue and reflect on awakening themes of our time. Today we're happy to have with us Bill Bowling, the Executive Director of the Atlanta Food Bank. The topic Bill and I will be examining today and in our next podcast session is Awakening Through Service. Bill, welcome to The Meeting Place Live. To start with, would you share a little about what you do at the Atlanta Food Bank? And also a little about what the Atlanta Food Bank does.
Well, I am the founder and executive director of the Atlanta Food Bank. We began in 1979, so, you know, we're 26, going on 27 years old. We operate like many food banks. There are over 200 in the country. Most cities have a food bank, in that we collect surplus and salvageable food, food that's unmarketable in many cases, and then redirect it or distribute it to community-based organizations, in our case, throughout the northern part of Georgia. We are a large program, so we'll distribute over 20 million pounds of food, and we have almost 800 organizations that are members here. That is, they access our services. Out of those 800, about 70% of them are congregations, Christians and Jews and Muslims and Hindus and others throughout the metropolitan area. So, you know, the food bank began actually out of the church, out of the basement of a downtown church in Atlanta, where we had started a community kitchen and other services for the homeless. It seems very appropriate that the majority of our member agencies are also congregations and people that are led by faith to do this kind of work.
When you say 20 million pounds, over what period of time is that?
That'd be in 1 year.
And so you distribute to a much larger area than just Atlanta.
Well, we actually serve throughout North Georgia, 38 counties, and I've helped start food banks throughout the state. So there are 8 food banks in Georgia. Of course, you've got that many in North Carolina and other states. About 25% of the product that we distribute out of Atlanta, we ship out to other food banks and other programs throughout the Southeast. So, you know, we often have a surplus and we're happy to share it.
Yeah.
But say in our case, and this really began, I think, out of my own calling to do this work, is that we really see food as a tool, as a vehicle for connecting with people and organizations. So we really use that food for the work of transformation. And we do that in many, many different ways. We handle prepared food, you know, from restaurants and caterers, so we interface with the hospitality industry. We build community gardens throughout the community and particularly focus on youth groups. We have a Hunger 101 curriculum, so we do a lot of education. We have a Hunger Walk every year where we bring the faith community together, raise over $200,000. I have a culinary training program where we take clients who often need food and empower them with a skill so that they can have good jobs. And finally, we distribute also school supplies directly to school teachers and interface with the educational community. So in every case, we work from our core competencies of knowing how to collect and distribute products, have a facility, inventory system, a distribution system, and work toward that higher purpose of providing commodities for ministries than to do what their mission calls them to do, which may be something much broader than just feeding the hungry.
Well, yeah, that's an area. There's two areas that I want to ask you about. One is when you say faith-based communities, are you talking about all different kinds of faiths, or are you talking about mostly Christian? Or,
well, being in Georgia and in the South, it's primarily Christian, but we have a number of synagogues, and increasingly we are working with the Muslim community. We even have, you know, a growing number of Hindu congregations, temples, in the Atlanta area. So we work, you know, across faith lines. In fact, this being March the 1st, 2006, only a month or so ago, there was a big holiday in the Muslim tradition. After the pilgrimage to the Hajj, they have a holiday where they sacrifice an animal, remembering the story of Abraham and Isaac, and they have donated, and this is kosher meat, very good meat, they have donated from the different mosque around town meat to be distributed to anybody who's hungry. We also work with the different religious holidays of each tradition, so it really gives us an opportunity to work with, to build trust, to understand the different traditions and faith groups.
The other question I had is, you used the word transformation, and I'm wondering what that word means when you use it. For instance, you did mention like the culinary school and helping people get jobs, and you mentioned gardening. I was thinking you probably were talking about vegetable gardens, but I wasn't sure. But in any case, what do you mean when you say you said that you use your work, the food, to connect with groups to support transformation?
Well, what I mean by it is that there is an opportunity, not a guarantee, but there's an opportunity when you have a need and you help fulfill that need. That is an engagement, and the transformation happens when one person helps another person, that they both gain, they both learn, and have the possibility of transforming their understanding of each other, transforming the understanding of themselves as the giver and receiver. Same way with organizations. If we can put those commodities in their hands, they may have a mission of helping the drug addicted or the people that are unhealthy, or maybe they're trying to work with youth who you know, don't have good home life, and they're able to provide that. So everybody needs to eat. There's a surplus, at least in our country, of food, and there is an opportunity to use that food as a way to engage folks at a place that we all have in common. Every faith tradition calls on their followers to feed the hungry, to take care of the poor, and to reach out heart to heart and help people. So we're really working with those commonalities in our diversity of our different traditions, our different history, but we have a common call, and we have a commodity here that we can use to answer that call.
And so I'm just still trying to understand it a little bit better. To get down to the most basic element, which is, you said, when you give something to someone and they receive something from you, both the giver and the receiver can be transformed in that exchange. And I'm wondering if you've ever seen anything like you're talking about. Like, what would be an example, if you could think of one.
Think of a thousand of them. And, I've had many of them. I'll give you a very obvious one. Yeah. When you can help a person who has come to you and said, you know, I don't have enough money for food, and you can put them through a training program to give them a job, a good-paying job, you have transformed their reality. You've transformed their life from one of being disempowered to being empowered.
So how would that work? Would it be like, you give them food with the understanding that they will also take some training?
In our case, it's a 16-week certified culinary training program. You know, 5 days a week, 8 hours a day, with homework every night. It's a very strenuous program, but you get a certificate and you get a job at the other end.
How do you get someone to commit to that program?
They self-select themselves. We offer it.
Uh-huh.
They decide if they want to step up
and
work in that way.
All right.
We do the same way in community gardening. We have found neighborhoods who have never worked together. You know, poor neighborhoods in the city or in the suburbs, neighborhoods who have never worked together on a common project, find a lot, decide to do a community gardening. It's amazing. It's usually the older folks who remember how to garden and it's the younger folks. I'm talking about real young kids who are just amazed to see that you plant a seed and it grows. We have community gardens where they build playgrounds next to them because it's where the kids like to hang out. So you have a multi-generational encounter that's going on.
Are you saying the garden was there first and then the playground came later?
That's correct. Because it became a gathering place.
Yeah.
Often kids would come to the garden because they might be in a fuss or a conflict about something, and they'll come to the elders, who are tending the garden. We also actually have a community garden program in the summer where we pay youth to supervise younger youth, and they learn the whole growing cycle. They learn about ecology. They actually learn about commerce, because if we harvest the crops, we take it to a farmer's market in town, and they actually handle the stand and handle the money. So, you're always looking for opportunities, to engage, educate, and empower the people that you're working with whatever commodity that you have at hand. I have people that are working for me at the food bank who, back in the 1970s and early 80s, used to come to my soup kitchen every day. And they were on the street, and they were lost, and they didn't have a job, and they didn't know what to do. I have several men who are working with me, who own a home, who've reconnected with their family, and I see a transformed life and then a transformed family, by them kind of coming in off the street, finding that job in a place that loves them and embraces them.
Oh. That's really amazing, and this all started out of a soup kitchen.
Started out of a soup kitchen in the basement of a church. So, one thing I can say is I didn't know what this would turn into. It was more answering a call than having a plan.
Uh-huh.
You just get up every day and do what you're called to do, and good things happen.
Well, that brings me up to another point, and that is wondering, I think a lot of people would like to particularly as they get a little older and they have time on their hands, if they're retired or semi-retired, they'd like to understand how they might be able to develop such a relationship, such a thing like you've done. I mean, not at the level you've done, but how to be of service to somebody. And I think what you said about doing what's natural for you and not really having a super big goal, but simply trying to be helpful might be a way to start.
I think it begins actually looking within instead of without. I think people often do it the other way around. They kind of survey the community and say, where might I go volunteer?
Yeah.
If you do the work, the internal work first, to know yourself, meaning to know enough about yourself to know what your competencies, core competencies, and are that you might offer, but also whether you like to work and serve an individual, a hands-on, work in a soup kitchen, look them in the eye, serve them soup. Other people may be called to do education, because at the end of the day, that's what we're talking about. Changing the way people think and the way that people act and their assumptions. So education is real key work. And ultimately, if we want to change the system, you've got to become an advocate. People don't give up power. They don't give up the way they do things without a fight. So you've really got to advocate for change. It's not that one work is more important than another. It's finding the right fit for you. So doing that, first doing that interior work and say, this is what I feel like I would like to do, and then going out and finding a place, experimenting and seeing if that fits. We're seeing, in 2006, a number of what we would call the baby boomers that are getting ready to retire. They've done well in life. They may have enough resources that they don't have to work. But we find over and over again, retirement doesn't fit everybody.
Yeah.
Or just playing golf and going fishing. You do that for a while, and then you say, I've got to have a deeper purpose in my life. So we see a huge resource coming down the line of people that have, really done their householder stage. They've raised a family. They've worked. They've saved. And they have a tremendous amount to offer. So finding the right place to make that offering is something that I know we're looking at the food bank. We would love to have those people involved. And I think in congregations and ministries throughout the country, we see this as a great possibility.
Well, do you have, you talk about interior work. Do you or are you aware of any place that supports people in doing that kind of work where they're actually consciously looking inside and trying to trying to gauge their assets and engage their desires and their deepest convictions and what would be appropriate?
I think, you know, you first kind of look at your own circle. If you're an Episcopalian or a Presbyterian or a Jew, depending on your own orientation, usually within your own community there are places to do that kind of retreat.
Uh-huh.
There's also, this doesn't sound very spiritual, but just, you know, doing some testing. even later in life, you know, kind of testing, you know, what really fits for me. A lot of times we get surprised. Learning about Enneagrams or, you know, doing your everything from Myers-Briggs to, you know, much more sophisticated kind of testing actually surprises you sometime with what you find out.
Hmm. Well, I'm also wondering about,
Hamayat, just to say one more word about that. You know, this is a place that Universal Awakening, I think, really has some opportunities.
Yeah.
You know, not only, hooking people up, you know, we can have a list of places that people may want to consider and a list of people, but also getting this dialogue going on. You know, I can make these suggestions and then there's variations off of it, or people can share their own experiences about kind of how they found their place.
Yeah.
Or how they found what fit for them.
Right, because in your job, you started ladling food. Now you're probably how far away from the ladling are you?
Well, I still volunteer and ladle, but I'm a long ways from ladling food. I run what would be the equivalent of a $30 million company here.
Yeah.
You know, that's another whole story about having to learn and grow and change my roles. And as I grew, I realized I couldn't do it all by myself, so I gathered people around and then empowered them, trusted them to take on part of the task. So that's a whole growth experience. And, you know, sometimes you get, I can just speak for myself, you get fearful, you know, that, gosh, I don't know if I can do this bigger job, or I don't know if I can trust those other folks to do it the way I used to. Do it.
Yeah.
And that's a whole personal growth that you go through as you grow, personally and organizationally.
So you must have hit that spot a number of times.
A number of times.
Yeah.
I would say that I'm in that spot yet again. As we look in our organization, and this is true, I think, in certainly in companies, it's very true in the nonprofit sector. And it's most true in the public sector right now. We're seeing a huge, you know, baby boomers coming through, people in their 50s who are getting ready to retire, and we're kind of looking back and saying, well, who's going to take these positions? And I think, you know, today we have not done a very good job of mentoring and teaching and getting people ready to step in these shoes. It's a big piece of the work right now.
Yeah, because some of the shoes that they have to step in aren't the shoes of working your way through. They're vertically, they would be horizontal, probably coming in horizontally to do a very specific task.
I think that's why you've got to be very intentional about it. Organizations or churches or what have you have to be very intentional about leadership development and about identifying the people that have the potential and really giving them the tools and the training and the trust to let them grow into those jobs.
Going back to what you were saying about Universal Awakening and looking at this as a way that Universal Awakening could offer, have something to offer, I'm wondering if you could say a little more about that. We've got that.
Well, one of the things that I have encountered over the years is that each community has its own language, its own way of framing things.
Uh-huh.
I often use the example, if you get business people and faith people and university people and the public sector people all in the same room, they're almost talking a different language.
Uh-huh.
They come at issues and problems and opportunities in a different way.
Right.
So I think in Universal Awakening, we are making that call and offering, you know, to a certain community. They're going to self-select if this feels like my community. And then through that work, I think we can find the language and the experiences and certainly the richness that, you know, bringing people together brings to find how those who are called to the sacred and those that are called to do the spiritual work in life can make that or translate that into ladling soup or running nonprofits or, you know, whatever it is. We've got to kind of grow where we're planted, but we've got to support each other while we're in that process.
It seems, I don't know if you would agree with this, but to me it seems that the vast majority of people I'm aware of anyway, who are involved with spiritual practice or on a spiritual path, haven't really been able to manifest that sense of service from the spiritual path. Maybe they have, but I'm just not aware of it. It seems like it's a real difficult jump to go from doing spiritual practices for your own development to doing something practical for someone else's welfare. I don't know if you've had that experience or not.
Well, I certainly did, and in my case, I studied, for many years in the Sufi community, also helped teach and run a community, and I have to say at a certain point for me, I felt like I've got to take what I've learned. What I feel in my heart, and I've got to manifest it somewhere. And, you know, we have to do it where we are.
Well,
our workplace, in our family, you know, wherever we are. And oftentimes I think that's a scary proposition, to go from what feels like a very safe place. You know, we know the practices, we know the environment that we're in, it feels very supportive, and then try to leave that supportive place and go out into the world. That's why I think it's absolutely essential to have a community to go back to.
Yeah.
You've got to have a place to recharge.
Well, did you, when you started out, did you have a community to go back to?
I did.
Okay.
And I lived in community for 10 years.
I
would dare say I wouldn't be in this work today had I not had a community. Not only that was a safe place for me to go back to, but a place that held me accountable. Who asked me hard questions and I had to find a way to articulate not only what I was feeling but what I was doing and then see if we could translate that into the teachings, you know, that we were receiving. At that point I didn't have a lot of material. I felt out on the edge, and I think all of us do. When we kind of leave that home and go out into the world.
Well, if you were going, if you were going back to intersect either in your spiritual community or spiritual home or in some spiritual community or home, or you were giving people advice about that today, which is, decades later, you must have some skills or some things that you could see. You might have some hard questions to ask them, not just wait to see if you can answer their hard questions. And I'm just wondering if you thought about that. And also I'm wondering if, as you were asked questions by your community in that during that 10-year period, whether you saw those dialogues that you had with people in some way activated them toward service.
I certainly think it did.
Uh-huh.
I mean, as I think, we're going back some years now, but when I think back in that original community, many of us evolved to a service job. Uh-huh. Maybe it was just our orientation. You know, there's a, I don't know if this is the right way to express this, but I think my deep sincerity in my call and in, you know, my call to serve, oftentimes would, you know, help me over the times that I didn't know how to do it.
Uh-huh.
Does that sound, you know, I was very sincere in knowing that I wanted to serve somehow. Sometimes I didn't quite know how to express it. I didn't know what the program would look like, and I'd have to go back to, you know, that kind of centered place and say, now, what was I called to do again? You know, why did I want to do this? It sure is hard. Can I get through this? You know, I think anything that's worthwhile is going to be difficult at times.
I want to close this session of the Meeting Place Live with a monthly meditation. I say a monthly meditation, although we'll have another meditation at the end of the next podcast. We're so often busy in our day, and we look for that pause that truly refreshes, and I'm not talking about Coca-Cola. And I have a brief meditation to offer you about this. It takes less than 45 seconds, and it can bring you to a place of clarity, harmonious thought and feeling, a deeper appreciation for life, and awakening to what's truly going on around you. I call this practice sipping light. First, close your eyes and watch the breath going in and out of your nostrils for a moment. Imagine that you are a crystalline chalice, and now open your eyes and look into the light outside a window, or if you're outside, just look into the light in the sky around you. Don't look directly at the sun, but look at the quality of light around you. And as you breathe in, imagine you're breathing in through your eyes and sipping that light, that quality of light from the sky around you, into you, filling up this crystalline goblet of yourself through your eyes on every inhalation. Each time you breathe in that light. And then when you feel yourself filled with that light, close your eyes and be aware of how that light is affecting you emotionally and how it is how it's fed and clarified your mind. If you would do this practice of sipping light, which is really just a few seconds, different times of the day, different days of the week, different weeks of the year, one of the things you'll begin to notice is that there are many different qualities of light and that each one affects you emotionally and mentally in many different ways, in many unique ways. And in time, you develop what I would call a palate of light, just like for those of you who may drink wine, you begin to taste different wines and you have information that you've received from all the wines that you've tasted before to help you discriminate and understand the information that wine is offering you. It's equally true with light. The more you do this practice, the more you're aware of what the qualities of light and the space around you, how they affect you, and what kind of information they're trying to pass on to you. Thank you for being with us at the Meeting Place Live. I invite you to check in about 2 weeks from now. We'll offer you the conclusion of Awakening Through Service with Bill Bowling, and also offer you another meditation that will enrich your life. In the meantime, at the bottom of the section in our website called Meeting Place Live, you'll see a space for comments. We invite you to make those comments and to read the comments that other people make as well. This is a way for you to actually dialogue with us, and we will bring some of those comments with us at the next time we check in. In the meantime, have a great life, have a full life, allow yourself to awaken to more and more life.